eContra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eContra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a cold, hard look at a philosophy that really dictates the fundamental trade-off of human civilization. Mm. We're talking about Thomas Hobbes and his terrifying creation, the Leviathan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you associate Hobbes with this, like, super gloomy view of human nature and the necessary evil of absolute monarchy, you're not wrong, but
yeah,
you might be missing a huge part of the story.
You're missing at least half of it, yeah.
Yeah.
For centuries, Hobbes has been read almost exclusively as a theorist of domestic conflict, you know, the guy who said the only way to stop a civil war is with an iron-fisted ruler.
Right.
But we're guided today by Richard Tuck's work, which it offers a really powerful challenge to that. Tuck argues Hobbes wasn't just obsessed with the English Civil War. He was one of the first truly systematic modern philosophers, and his whole political solution was driven by two foundational pillars.
Okay, what are they?
The new mechanistic science, and maybe even more importantly, the persistent reality of international anarchy.
So our mission today is to trace that unforgiving logical chain, the cold reasoning, that leads from Hobbes's materialist view of the human mind and body all the way to his ultimate unsettling political solution. The absolute sovereign.
Exactly.
And why should you care about this 17th century thinker now? Well, because Hobbes provides the starkest, a deeply coherent justification for sacrificing liberty for the sake of stability. He gets right to the root causes of political instability, both civil and international, in a way that still frames our debates today.
And to really appreciate this deep dive, we need to know our guy. That's Richard Tuck. Mm. He's the Frank G. Thompson Professor of Government at Harvard, and he's widely considered a leading authority on 17th century political thought, especially Hobbes and his contemporary Hugo Grotius, who sort of pioneered international law.
So what makes Tuck's approach so different? What's the game changer here?
It's his rigor. He's not just doing a simple reading. He's diving into deep archival research. He's mastered the Latin sources. And he situates Hobbes squarely in his original intellectual context, you know, the world of Renaissance humanism and this new emerging science.
So he sees the whole picture.
He sees the whole picture. Right. And that lets him see connections other scholars totally missed, especially this global perspective that really drove Hobbes's conclusions.
So it's not just a hobby.
No, his whole methodology hinges on proving that Hobbes was a systematic thinker. His early fascination with geometry and Galileo's scientific method weren't just intellectual side projects. They were the engine that drove his political theory.
Okay.
Tuck avoids that common caricature of Hobbes as just some bitter royalist. Instead, he reveals the internal logic of a man desperately seeking a science of politics, like a guaranteed mathematical method for achieving lasting peace, one that's immune to human passion and religious fights.
That ambition is just incredible. So let's look at the core structure Tuck reveals. He wants to recover the authentic Hobbes, right? Resenting this unified philosophical system where every conclusion just flows from the initial ideas.
And that system is built on those two pillars we mentioned. So pillar one is science and skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
Hobbes was living during the 17th century skeptical crisis. So what does that mean? It means the traditional foundations for authority, Aristotelian physics, classical philosophy, the divine right of kings, religious certainty, they were all crumbling at the same time.
It sounds like total chaos.
It was intellectual anarchy, which, you know, naturally breeds political anarchy. So Hobbes sought absolute certainty to counter this, and he found it in the undeniable rigor of geometry and the new materialist science from people like Galileo.
So he wanted to build politics on axioms, like a math proof.
Exactly. Something that couldn't be disputed, unlike, say, a theological claim.
And pillar two is the revolutionary part, this reinterpretation. Tuck argues that Hobbes's famous description of the state of nature, that horrifying war of all against all, it wasn't really about individual cavemen fighting over berries.
Not primarily, no. It was, first and foremost, an analysis of the ongoing reality of conflict and distrust between sovereign states in the international system. It was about the tragedy of global anarchy.
Wow.
Yeah. And when you combine this mechanistic, rational search for certainty with the constant danger of a world with no global police force, well, the resulting Leviathan, the absolute state becomes the inescapable logical conclusion.
So absolute domestic sovereignty is. It's the necessary condition for survival in a world that's fundamentally dangerous.
The state has to be strong enough to survive in the environment it lives in, yes.
Okay, let's start that descent into the logic then, starting with the human blueprint. Hobbes was a strict materialist. He argued that everything, the mind, imagination, even our will, is just matter in motion. There's no soul driving the bus.
Right. And if the human is a machine, its behavior is just a reaction to external forces. Hobbes defines all action based on motion. Appetite is motion towards something that helps us, which we then subjectively label good.
And aversion.
Aversion is motion away from something that hurts us, which we then label evil.
So morality is radically subjective. If I want wealth, it's good for me. If I fear getting sick, it's evil.
Yeah.
For me. There's no universal standard. That seems terrifying. It removes any foundation for shared ethics.
It is terrifying, and it's absolutely essential to his politics. Since there's no common or objective good, the only universal truth we can all agree on is the most fundamental motion, the desire for self-preservation and that overwhelming shared aversion to violent death.
Fear.
That fear is the engine of politics. It's the one constant everyone can measure.
This is where it gets really interesting. You take these fearful, subjective, but rational human beings, and you remove all external enforcement. That's the state of nature. But as you said, Tuck says we need to see this through the lens of international relations.
Right. Tuck argues that the famous line where Hobbes describes life in the state of nature as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, well, that's a perfect description of the condition of nations constantly fighting for resources and security.
So no nation can ever truly relax.
Never. They are always fortified, always on guard, knowing that any other nation is a potential threat.
That makes so much more sense. But what about the specific causes of conflict? Whether it's between people or nations, Hobbes identified three core psychological drivers that just guarantee war.
The three domestic causes, yep. First, you have competition. People or states want the same limited resources, so they have to fight for them. Simple enough.
Okay.
Second is diffidence. This is profound distrust. Because I know you're rational and you might attack me first just to be safe, I am rationally compelled to strike you first just to survive.
That's the classic security dilemma we see all the time in foreign policy. The Cold War arms race is a perfect example of diffidence. You build weapons not because you want war, but because you're afraid of the other side.
Which then makes the other side more afraid of you. It's a self-perpetuating cycle of distrust. A perfect analogy.
And the third one.
The third cause is glory. Fighting over reputation, honor, prestige. This isn't just about resources or safety. It's about being recognized, which is a powerful driver for both human kings and nation states seeking global standing.
But because man is rational, he quickly figures out the laws of nature, like, you know, the rational need to seek peace and lay down arms if others do too. But that's not enough, is it? Because of that diffidence problem.
It's not enough. Correct. So the rational way out is the social contract. Individuals agree to transfer their right to everything to the artificial man, the sovereign.
And the sovereign's role is key here.
It's critical. The sovereign is the beneficiary of the contract, not a party to it. You make a contract with your fellow citizens to obey the sovereign, but the sovereign owes you only one thing, security.
Wait, okay. Isn't this where Hobbes loses pretty much everyone? If the sovereign isn't a party to the contract and has no obligation back to the people, why must the power be absolute? Can it just be strong, but with checks?
Because Hobbes is terrified of civil war. He saw what happened in England when power was divided between the king and parliament.
It led to chaos.
Divided power, even with good intentions, inevitably leads to disagreement, stalemate, and then civil strife. And once that fighting starts, the state risks dissolving, and boom, you're thrown right back into the nightmare of the state of nature.
So for Hobbes, the power has to be absolute.
Whether it's held by a monarch or a council, it has to be absolute because that is the minimum requirement for stability. Any checks, any balances, any division of power, they're just seeds of future conflict.
And as Tuck emphasizes, this absolute domestic power is fundamentally justified because a strong, unified state is the necessary condition for survival against the constant threat of that anarchic international system.
Exactly. Weakness invites invasion.
Now, we have to talk about the most radical part of Leviathan, the deliberate subordination of religion to political power. I mean, he spends a huge amount of time on this in the book.
He had to. For Hobbes, religious conflict was the ultimate source of civil war. Allegiance to conflicting claims, say, a pope versus a king or some private revelation versus public law, was literally killing the Commonwealth.
People would rather die for their idea of God's will than obey the law.
Precisely. So what was his breathtakingly bold solution?
Well, he didn't outlaw Christianity, did he?
No, but he strictly divided faith into public and private spheres. The sovereign must interpret scripture and dictate the only permissible form of public worship and doctrine. This is the crucial step.
Okay, so what I believe in my heart is my business.
Right. What you believe internally is a matter between you and God. The sovereign can't touch that inner faith. But politically, your external religious practice must be subordinate to the state. And this just completely neutralizes religious authority as a force for civil strife.
It's genius in a chillingly utilitarian way. It eliminates the threat of a divine challenge to the sovereign by making the ruler the supreme interpreter of public faith,
yes.
Guarantees unity of command.
Precisely. The sovereign becomes the ultimate temporal and spiritual authority, so no one can use a claim of divine authority to challenge the state's command and risk a return to anarchy.
So what is this coherent, materialist, and ultimately, you know, pessimistic system teach us today? Let's pull out the major themes. Mm-hmm. Theme one has to be the primacy of peace and fear. The whole system is built on prioritizing avoiding violent death above everything else.
And this forces us to confront that perpetual trade-off, right? Security versus liberty. Hobbes argues that security isn't just some nice outcome. It's the prerequisite for any meaningful liberty at all.
Right. Without the state's protection, your freedoms are meaningless because your life is constantly threatened.
By diffidence and competition, yeah.
Okay. Theme two, the tragic nature of politics. Conflict is just an inevitable feature of the international world because there's no supreme global authority, no world Leviathan, to enforce rules between states.
And that reflection explains why, despite countless attempts, international law and institutions persistently struggle. They are, to use Hobbes's famous phrase, merely covenants without the sword.
No global police force.
No global coercive power to guarantee compliance. It means treaties will always be fragile when national interests clash.
And theme three, the one Tuck really highlights, is the intimate connection between political order and international anarchy. Domestic stability isn't an internal luxury. It's a strategic necessity imposed by a dangerous, competitive external world.
Mm-hmm. And this is why, on the world stage, a failed state is never just a local tragedy, is it? It instantly becomes a geopolitical security threat. It creates a power vacuum that attracts external competition and destabilizes its neighbors. Hobbes gave us the intellectual framework for understanding that centuries ago.
The elegance of Hobbes's terrifying system is often captured in these really concise, powerful statements that have echoed through the centuries. I mean, you hear them all the time.
They're magnificent rhetorical weapons. And let's look at what gives them their power, especially when you see them through Tuck's international lens.
Okay, quote number one, "The condition of man is a condition of war of everyone against everyone."
The power of that quote isn't just its pessimism, it's how universal it is. Tuck shows it applies to states even when they have ambassadors and trade deals. The war isn't always fought with bombs. It's fought with distrust, with economic competition, with constant preparations for violence.
So peace is just a pause?
It's just a pause in hostilities enforced by mutual fear.
Quote number two, "Covenants without the sword are but words."
This is pure Hobbesian realism. It's the rhetorical dagger that cuts through all idealism, reminding you that power comes before principle. Any agreement, any treaty, is basically meaningless without a credible coercive power, the sword, to enforce it.
And the final one, describing the state itself. "The sovereign is the public soul, giving life and motion to the commonwealth."
I love that one. It elevates sovereignty above just some legal definition. It's not just a person wearing a crown. It is the living spirit that animates the political body. It ensures its internal mechanism runs smoothly and critically, that it has the power to defend itself and survive in that competitive international environment.
So how does this 17th century system directly inform the headlines we read, you know, every morning?
Well, application one is the founding of realist international relations theory. If you study global politics today and you focus on how nations prioritize self-interest and military strength over shared values, you are studying a direct derivative of Hobbes. His framework is still the foundation for understanding global power dynamics.
And application two is that constant, painful debate on liberty versus security. Hobbes' logic is the core justification used for things like mass surveillance or emergency powers. The state compels you to surrender certain freedoms by appealing directly to your most fundamental rational drive, the aversion to violent death. It's a transaction that happens every single time a major security measure is proposed.
And application three, understanding state sovereignty in a global world. Tuck's interpretation explains why nations are so reluctant to surrender ultimate sovereignty to institutions like the World Court or the UN.
Because for a Habesian state, sovereignty is the only guarantee of survival.
The only one. Giving it up is risking oblivion, which is, you know, an existential non-starter.
For me, what stands out most from Tuck's work is the terrifying intellectual coherence of it all. The Leviathan isn't just a plea for tyranny. It is the absolute logical endpoint of Hobbes's materialist science and his commitment to finding a verifiable, guaranteed way out of conflict. I mean, his quest for a true science of politics feels profoundly modern.
And I think the most valuable lesson is that recognition that political theory and international relations are just inseparable. You can't have one without the other. Hobbes forces us to acknowledge that the persistent, tragic conflicts we see globally are not accidental or based on some temporary misunderstanding.
They're structural.
They stem from the structural reality of having no global sword. Yeah. His diagnosis of the human sources of conflict, competition, distrust, and glory remains chillingly relevant, even in our globalized, interconnected world.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.